FOMO.
I want to be living long enough that when my kids and other kids are polled and asked, do you think your life will be better than your parents? 90% of them will say, yeah, far better. I'm going to live till I'm 150 and I'm going to live a healthy life and because of what technology can do for me. Not the current situation that we have where if you poll kids right now, you know, the vast majority of them say, I don't think my life is going to be as good as my parents.
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out. And it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. FOMO. FOMO. Welcome to another episode of FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. Today, I have a truly entrepreneurial thinker on the show talking about big ideas, and he is taking his entrepreneurial acumen and he's applying it to the sphere of public policy and kind of how to make our world work better, particularly when it comes to our digital rights. So it's a big topic, and the man to talk about this is Frank McCourt Jr. He is the executive chairman of McCourt Global, a private family enterprise working across real estate, sports, technology, media, and capital investment. He's also the founder of Project Liberty, a far-reaching effort to build an internet where individuals have more control over their data. Really important topic. Frank has been, you know, a very public figure. He was the owner of the Dodgers in LA, so that was a hugely public role. He's also put his money where his mouth is. He has established the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown, my alma mater, with two gifts of $100 million to get that started. And so very much dovetails with all the work he's doing. What's great about this interview is you're going to meet somebody who's just a builder, and you're going to see how he thinks and also how he's taking his vision and trying to make an impact in the world in which we live to the benefit of all of us. So that's the conversation. And as you know, I like to get started with the same question every time. So I started by asking Frank this. Tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
Great question. That I have the power to cause change by influencing other people to find or encouraging other people to find that same power in them.
That's a good thing to discover. Now, before we get into the subject, your new book is called Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, which you co-authored with Michael J. Casey. But before we get into that, I do want to take the advantage of having you here. And just, you know, I just read your bio in the intro. You started in real estate. You've been in the sports world. You have then moved into, you know, aggressively into public service and trying to shape the way that this world is moving. And I just like to ask you, as you think about your trajectory, what is the through line? What has been your mental model for choosing how you focus your time and your talent?
From the perspective of a builder and problem solver. So I'm grew up in a big Irish family in Boston, one of seven kids, and you know, I can still hear my mom's voice at the dinner table as me and my siblings would rattle on about all the problems in the world, right? That kids are usually pretty good at identifying. And no dinner would finish without her saying, you know, you kids have done a good job identifying the problem. Now, what are you going to do about it? And so it really motivates me. It's been something that I've really, you know, just animates my activities. I kind of focus on not the challenge, but the opportunity, and not the helplessness, but the hopefulness in things, and try to really envision solutions, analyze the problem, of course, but then envision a solution and then bring it forward into the world, as opposed to, like, you know, keeping it in my head or keeping it to myself and knowing that I alone can't change anything. But if you can bring forward ideas that other people iterate on and improve and so on and so forth, and if they become everybody's idea and becomes better and better, then in fact things do change. And I think also the fact that I'm a fifth generation builder, you know, the family's been building and problem solving and designing and building infrastructure and other things. That so we kind of, after 131 years, know a little bit about how things work, and we've been involved in the evolution of things, including technology. So it's not like it's at all foreign to us. And so, yeah, I think the upbringing combined with the builder, you know, training and experience, it gives me a way of thinking about things and processing the world around me.
You know, you got Patrick McGinnis here from Maine. We got Frank McCourt from Boston. We're both happy warriors, so you're in the right place today. And I want to focus on the topic of this new book, because, you know, you talk about building and taking on challenges. And this this challenge that you're taking on is no small feat. I mean, this is a really, it's one of the big, I think, one of the big challenges of our time, which is how technology is shaping our lives and our society. But just to get started, your book, Our Biggest Fight, what is, you know, what is the big idea in this book?
You know, connecting this to the what I just said earlier, I think the biggest idea of the book is converting helplessness into hopefulness by returning and reclaiming our personhood from big tech's machines. And I think that kind of says it all. And, you know, I see and feel the same problems, Patrick, that you see and feel with, you know, that are being caused by the current technology, you know, ranging from lack of civil discourse and mis and disinformation and the foreign power influence in our elections to the harms to children. And we, rather than be paralyzed by this and feel like, oh, this is just the way I guess it is, and we'll kind of just all be resigned to mopping up the problems or living with it, let's fix it so that this awesome technology can be used to, in a much more helpful, constructive, harmonious way with society's objectives. And that's what it's about. That's what Our Biggest Fight is about, and that's why it's our biggest fight. Because big tech is, you know, they're powerful, you know, companies and platforms, call them what you will, that are sitting on the most valuable information in the world, and that's everything about us that they've mapped. That information provides incredible insight to the algorithms that they then create to not only sell us things, that's the least of it, but feed us information and trigger us and get us to think in certain ways and manipulate us. Because now it's so much information in their hands that they're able to make judgments about our personality, our emotional makeup, and so on and so forth. It's gone way beyond just, oh, this person might like to buy this or that. So this is now, and it's ubiquitous in our lives. We're digital creatures now, and that's not going away. So let's make sure that the digital world we live in is operating and optimizing for what we as individuals and society and communities want.
FOMO. Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now that right there was Portuguese, and as you know, I love speaking foreign languages. But I'm not alone. 1 in 5 Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak 4 languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply.
FOMO. One thing that really struck me as I read through the book is you know, you sort of, you lay out, things don't feel quite right. Like if you stop for a second, put down your phone, which we should all do a lot more, and you look at the problems, whether it's sort of like the lack of civil discourse, the paralysis of our government, the cultural disunity, a lot of these things that, you know, kind of crept up on us. And then one day you wake up and you're like, whoa, January 6th. It's, you know, a lot, I think a lot of people don't realize like the, what you're talking about in this book, like you're connecting the dots between a lot of these societal woes or failures of our institutions and technology. So maybe to get started, as we delve deeper into this, talk about the problem, like frame up the problem in why technology and the way that these tech companies are using our data is feeding into an outcome that is, you know, creating all these societal problems.
Zoom out and think about how the internet operates. It operates because we've adopted some basic core protocols that were hoping for a decentralized internet, which would empower people and, you know, be the rising tide that lifted all people boats, you know? And so when those few researchers got together in the 70s and early 80s to create for our government what was really an alternative communication system, one that was decentralized and so wouldn't be vulnerable to, at the time, the fear was an attack from the Soviet Union in the Cold War era. They came up with this idea of connecting these our devices, computing devices, by adopting a protocol or two protocols that were, are co-joined called Transfer Control Protocol / Internet Protocol, which is TCP/IP. So suddenly, when these devices were connected, now we had the internet. You know, we had this powerful decentralized communications technology. All these years later, we're still an IP address on the internet. We are, you and I are still a device on the internet. We're not a person on the internet. And I'll get back to that in a moment. And then that was, so that was 83. And in 89, Tim Berners-Lee came up with this, you know, brilliant idea. Again, another thin layer protocol called Hypertext Transfer Protocol, HTTP, which we all, you know, use and have adopted, which created data linkage. So now you have devices linked and data linked. And again, really hopeful vision for a decentralized internet. And let's get into the internet into everybody's hands. They'll do the right thing with it. And as we now have this awesome opportunity to, you know, where both devices and data are linked. And then about 20 years ago, something really important happened, which took things on a totally different track, and that was the beginning of the app era. And apps entered the picture, saw all this data that was up for grabs, and, you know, these companies fed us, quote, free, quote, end quote, devices and uses to capture our data, knowing that the value in all this was going to be the collecting and aggregating that data, which provided tremendous insight to these organizations, and then they would figure out what to do with it. And, you know, they figured out, for instance, that selling ads would be very profitable, right? And they would by learning more and more about individuals and making a more and more fine-grained assessments, they'd be able to presumably push in front of them things that they might want to buy. But it's gone, like I said, way beyond that now. It's actually, well, you mentioned January 6th as a good example of triggering sort of certain behavior and so on and so forth. So this app era changed this decentralized utopian vision of the internet into something that was highly centralized, has become highly autocratic and surveillance-based. So now we're all connected to the internet, not just by social media, which is an obvious way we're connected, or just not just by searching or shopping, but everything almost everything that's being built and you know, including automobiles and, you know, televisions and appliances in our home and so on, are all connected to the internet, the so-called, you know, Internet of Things. You know, a Tesla is a smartphone on wheels, right? That's what it essentially is today. So we're living in the digital world. And I was about to say we're digital citizens, but we're actually not. We're becoming digital subjects. And we're losing our citizenship in a digital era. And what, you know, the book talks about, and the reason I was so inspired by Thomas Paine, who actually encouraged his fellow, they weren't even citizens at the time because this predated democracy, but his fellow settlers in what became the United States and the colonies, he said, you know, you can continue to be a subject of a monarchy if you want, or you can choose citizenship, be a citizen, you know, be born with unalienable rights. You know, be self-governed. Wouldn't that be much better? Wouldn't that feel much better? Wouldn't that liberty be empowering and uplifting? And sure enough, you know, the United States was formed, you know, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, in a way, thin layer protocols that we built the greatest country in the world on top of. And that idea of creating human rights and property rights and things that we owned, and, you know, your forefathers and mine, you know, left a place where they had no rights, and you know, to speak of, they really couldn't own much, and it was even limited how much they could eat, right? So they were controlled by a monarch who they never met, never saw, and just by fate. And then when they came here, suddenly they opened up a whole world, not only for themselves, and they made the sacrifice, not you and I, and we're beneficiaries of all that. And my point in the book is, why would we give up all of those rights, you know, that being a citizen and being able to own things, you know, all the rights that came with democracy in a market capital, you know, market economy, why would we give those up just to be able to use the internet? It seems like that's not free. At least to me, that's very, very expensive. And that is giving up everything we love, quite frankly. And so let's be citizens in a digital world and have the same values and ideals updated for the 21st century, be embraced by the technology we use, as opposed to having one set of principles in our, you know, in our democratic operating system and a totally different set of principles in our technological operating system, and they're totally different systems. They're not in harmony at all. And I would go so far as to say democracy will not survive with autocratic, centralized surveillance technology. Autocracies will do awesomely well.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the best place for an autocracy to thrive is in a place where you are centralizing and stripping people of their individual rights. And you write in the book, and this was really, I wrote this down because I thought it was striking. You said, in the internet era, you have been stripped of your rights. You have no agency. You are not a citizen. You are a vassal, a serf, a subject beholden to the demands of your digital feudal overlords. That's pretty stark. And I just wonder, as we think about that, so, you know, that is, it's a really important reframing of, it's like, oh, I love TikTok. Well, that's nice. But if you flip the way you think about this and recognize that you're being manipulated in a bunch of different ways by all of these devices and apps, then it's not so enjoyable. But I ask myself, and I'd love your thoughts on this. So, like, as I think about the many forces on the internet that are that are behind this, like, yeah, part of it is hackers and bots, and part of it is bad actors and propagandists, and part of it is for-profit companies that have a product that unfortunately has a very negative externality. And so as you think about all this, like, how much of this, is there like a big plan? Are there like, you know, evil puppet masters behind the scenes? Or is this just a situation where you have this like unregulated, very unstructured market, and because of that, all of these actors come together in a very toxic way that has led to where we are today?
I think it's a difference without a distinction in mm-hmm. many ways. And what I mean by that is, I'll let others be the judge of intent. What I know is that the leaders of these platforms now know that their practices, their algorithms, their products are harming children. They're addictive products, based on dopamine hits. They are undermining democracy. They are completely contaminating our information ecosystem, and they're eroding civil discourse, right? So we now know, and they know, that the current setup is having all these harmful effects. So it needs to be fixed. And what the book is saying, what Project Liberty is doing, is saying, look, this is an engineering problem. It's an engineering problem because something that was built to be good for human beings and be centralized was co-opted by these big centralized platforms that basically don't consider us human beings at all. They're just mining information about us and then doing stuff with it to make money and gain the power and the influence that comes with that. So regardless of the intentions, and I think each company probably had leadership with different intentions, and again, I think that's for other experts to opine on. And what I know is that they all know now that the current architecture is broken and it's doing a great deal of harm, and they're not fixing it. And I find that very upsetting, and which is why I and the others in Project Liberty have come forward with a fix to this, which is basically yet another core open source protocol, which would give each of us agency again, ownership and control of our data. We'll decide who gets to use our data on what basis. The new apps that get built will click on our terms and conditions of use. We won't be clicking on the terms and conditions of use of big platforms that, the biggest thing these terms and conditions do is make it a nuisance, right, to use the internet, because you have to keep clicking on and getting by. You just want, this, we only have one internet essentially that we can work with right now, so there really isn't a choice. We need to create an alternative, give people a choice, an alternative that's just as easy to use, just as fun to use, just as much more informative, because we take all the garbage out of the system, and much more trustworthy, because you have to be a person to be on it, or at least be able to verify that you're a person. And it's the data is not centralized where it's super hackable. It's decentralized, and there's shared state. And the network effect is available to anyone that builds on it, because the data is part of the internet itself. It's not the property of a few platforms, etc. Oh, and the apps are interoperable in our social graphs, to use the technical term of what our data looks like to these big platforms. It's everything about us, our relations, our behavior, what we do, where we go, how we think, how we're going to react, etc., as well as what we'll buy and how we shop and what we search for. All of that social graph information should be ours and be portable. And this is all doable. And so let's do it. Let's fix the engineering problem and for the first time have an internet where we're not a device on the internet. We're a person, and we can't pretend we're someone we're not, and we can't pretend we're 10 people, and you can't be a machine just spewing out whatever. There's integrity restored to this incredibly powerful and, I would say, vital piece of technology that we all now have grown dependency on. And imagine an internet with integrity restored, what that could do to protect kids, and what that could do to strengthen democracy, and what that could do to advance the pursuit of knowledge, and so on and so forth. I'm hugely optimistic about the future if we can fix this. You know, I want to be living long enough that when my kids and other kids are polled and asked, do you think your life will be better than your parents? 90% of them will say, yeah, far better. I'm going to live till I'm 150, and I'm going to live a healthy life, and because of what technology can do for me. Not the current situation that we have, where if you poll kids right now, you know, the vast majority of them say, I don't think my life is going to be as good as my parents. And that's all we need to know. We don't need any other polling. I mean, our sacred metric is leaving the world better than we found it, right? And in making life better for the next generation. And if the next generation is saying, I don't think my life is going to be better, then we're failing. And let's fix that. And I'm glad you pointed out that a lot of the problems we're having right now in society can all be linked back to how the tech is designed and how it is impacting our lives in causing these problems. And by the way, problems that we have to address that are sucking up massive resources, massive time, energy, and precious resource, that could all of that time and creativity and money and so forth, imagine if it was redirected towards actually solving the other problems that we can't get to because we're spending so much time arguing with each other or debating if, you know, we don't even have a shared set of facts. Hard to solve problems when you don't have a shared set of facts, you know. And so, and this technology is designed to keep us in a triggered state where we will always be arguing and defending our view of the facts as opposed to somebody else's view of the facts. And that's a far cry from us debating two different opinions, but to be debating two different sets of alternative facts. I mean, if big tech as designed and social media as used was around when the debate was going on, you know, over whether the earth was flat or round, we'd still be stuck in that debate with each side defending their reality, right? And how do you actually develop all of the things we developed when we moved from a flat earth, you know, perspective to a round earth perspective? You know, it's pretty radical, right? It's pretty amazing. Well, if we're all stuck in a debate over whether the earth is flat or round, then I don't think those advances ever get made.
FOMO. FOMO. There was a time in this country and in this world where polluters could just do whatever they wanted. And if you were to tell everybody today that all the water we drink secretly is full of poison that's going to kill us, we would do something about it, one likes to think. Although it's very interesting because I think about that movie Don't Look Up that was a bit of a hit last year, where there was a comet that was going to hit Earth. And because of disinformation and all the things we've been talking about, like, people didn't believe it and they sort of didn't do anything. So we also have to get together and address these things. But this is exactly, to me, like a pollutant. And that maybe we don't realize it because, you know, we're distracted or we haven't connected the dots per se, but you're doing that for us. And we can say there is a pernicious thing. We can fight over who to blame, fine, but that's not going to solve the problem. We just need a solution. And we need to reimagine how we're doing things, because we have all this wonderful technology that should be making our lives better, but yet somehow our expectations versus reality, we're not hopeful at this point. So just talking about, you know, as we look at maybe, you know, sort of actually implementing the open source decentralized protocol upgrade that you talk about, what does that process look like? How do we actually get this done?
Yeah, I love your example about pollution and particularly polluted water. Because I'm struck by a point of view or argument that I hear from some people who say, Yeah, there's some harms that are done by, you know, social media and surveillance technology, but aren't there a lot of really good things that are also done? And don't they, you know, kind of on balance kind of outweigh the harms? And of course, there are some good things that technology does. But let's just say I'm installing a water system in your community of 1 million people, and we turn on the water to go into the 1 million homes, and 600,000 of them get clean, healthy, nutritional water, and 400,000 get toxic poison water that is harming the households and actually killing some of the people in those households. Do we sit back and say, well, on balance, you know, on balance, that water system is doing more harm than more good than harm? You know, I think not. I think we are outraged, and we say, this is a scandal. Fix the water system, you know, contractor. Fix the water system, municipality. Fix the water system, government. You know, whoever's responsible, somebody has to be responsible first and foremost. And then you say, okay, to that responsible party, fix it and fix it now. This is outrageous. And then there'd be lawsuits and there'd be, you know, we'd be, and why is that? It's because the water is tangible and it's in our homes and it's making our kids sick and we get outraged as a community. You know, I would argue that what's going on with technology right now and the internet and how and social media specifically and so forth is that it is making us sick. It is actually killing some children and not just children, by the way. It is having, let's put it this way, very, very harmful effects to society. And there are two issues that we need to overcome in answer to your question. One, this can't continue to be an abstract problem. You know, water's tangible, data is abstract. It's like ethereal, right? So we need to change that. And secondly, we need to bring this into people's homes, to their kitchen table, as a water issue would be. So what I argue in the book and the case I make in the book, that it's a mistake to think of data as this, you know, abstract, unimportant thing. Think about it instead as who you are in the digital era. It's your personhood. It's your very being. It's as important as your biological DNA. It's your digital DNA. It's everything. The difference is you're born with a biological DNA. The digital DNA is your entire lived experience now from when you're born. And by the way, your biological DNA is going to be digitized and until you die. That's your life captured in a digital format, right? So it's not this abstract thing about like data, why should I care? No, it's you. And right now you don't own you. These big platforms own you. And we want us back. I want to own me. I don't want them to own me. And if I want to, you know, be able to function with the sense of liberty and freedom and agency and autonomy and control, and I'm in charge of my life, and that's the whole American project, then I need to own and control my data and decide what's done with it, because it is me in the digital age. It's everything about me. And the second thing we need to do is, as I said, we need to bring this issue away from a technology discussion. And it needs to be a discussion in homes, at the kitchen table, on the sideline of soccer fields, in schools. You know, we need people to insist, go into schools and say, like, what are you teaching my kids about this? How are you protecting my children from this? Because, by the way, teachers are... they're looking for a solution too, because, you know, the phone and the smartphone and social media so is the biggest impediment now to learning. And it's also what it's creating in terms of dysfunction And do we really want our kids on smart devices in schools where all of that information about them is being scraped as well and being exploited? You know, I don't think so. And this doesn't even get to the issue of, you know, being a child and growing up and making mistake after mistake after mistake that we all made as children, which is exactly how we learned, but we were able to be forgiven for those mistakes because they weren't captured for posterity, right? They were mistakes made, forgotten, and something written on a piece of paper that was thrown into the trash can. You know, now everything is captured and it is weaponized. And it comes back to be used to hurt someone. And the people that are, you know, using the internet to do harm are, you know, that's the intent of the person using it, right? It's to weaponize it and to harm and bully and hurt. I mean, we've all met bullies growing up, but we weren't bullied by thousands of strangers and, you know, in at 3 o'clock in the morning and kept up at night and felt, and you know, it's just, this is a crisis. You know, that's another point I make in the book, that this, we can't just keep kicking this can down the road. We need to deal with this. And the we is all of us. You know, sadly, our elected officials are not dealing with it. We've all seen that, you know, the hearings, and it provides great theater, you know, congressional hearings, and it provides great theater. But then we don't see the results. And then a year or two go by and there's another set of hearings because another set of harms come forward and then we don't see the results. And interestingly, Patrick, it's the same. Normally we would think, okay, we identify a problem like polluted water or like tobacco or this or that, and you bring it to the attention of our elected officials and they may even run on the basis of saying we're gonna clean up the water or prevent smoking for, you know, because it's killing people, or at least it prevent children from smoking. But our political system is disabled now by the same technology that we're talking about. And so, you know, these elected officials are, you know, big tech is in their ear and writing checks to support them. And they're using the very platforms that I'm talking about to get reelected. And they've figured out that the most extreme behaviors get the most clicks too, right? And get the most followers and raise the most funds. So it's just very, very poorly designed technology if your societal goals are protect children, you know, a pursuit of knowledge and truth, and strengthen, you know, self-governance and democracy and civil discourse and so on and so forth. We're optimizing for something very, very different. And we're all left here with this kind of wobbly situation where we're wondering, like, what the heck is going on here? Well, you know, what's going on here is that we have, you know, this omnipresent technology in our lives that is not designed to do the things that we as individuals, you know, would design it to do, or we as communities would design it to do. So we need to fix this dissonance, right? Because there's no harmony between the two, and this is very, very fixable. And I think when people understand this not as a tech issue, but as a social issue and set of issues, that we'll start to make progress. So Project Liberty does have a tech track, and we do put forward this open source protocol and this idea that we invite others to iterate on and improve, or if they have a better idea, come forward and we'll support that idea. But it also is bringing forward the social scientists and all the smart people in the world to work with, you know, the technologists and the computer scientists this time, and not just to, quote, move fast and break things, right? Actually, let's get it right now, knowing what the internet is capable of. And then thirdly, let's bring civil society into this. Let's bring the mums. Let's give the mums a place to go to actually affect change, you know, instead of just pleading and begging for regulations that are not coming to, you know, fix this. And I just don't think the regulatory apparatus right now, it can move quickly enough to keep up with big tech. I hope that changes with healthier technology. We'll be back now to some semblance of, you know, some equilibrium where our elected officials will be able to represent us again and really use the new and improved version of the internet, you know, to as a way to actually find out what their constituents are thinking and deliver what, you know, the priorities of their constituency. And you know, we'll be able to engage in the political process in a healthy way, in a constructive way. And I don't think that future is too far away. I think once people realize that this is fixable, they'll want the new version very quickly. And I know when we built a telecom company back in the 90s, once people realized that they could actually have their phone number was portable and they weren't stuck with a single carrier, they could actually pick and choose the carrier they wanted, you know, who gave them a free phone or had a stronger signal or a cheaper rate or whatever, that empowered people. And it also was a boom for the telecom industry because all kinds of investment went into it. So I think we can do this. And I'm really optimistic about it, but I'm not also, I know it's not going to be easy, and that's why it's not my biggest fight, it's our biggest fight.
Yeah, it needs entrepreneurial thinkers from all the aspects of our society, whether it's from the business side, the policy side, to just step back for a second and you know, you've given us a roadmap. And then within that, fill in the blanks about how we can all work together to change the way we're doing things. So it can't just be one person imposes this, you know, that's not the society we live in. But if we don't start asking these questions now, we're tap dancing our way into a really, really bad place.
Yeah, it's kind of like the frog boiling, right? I mean, it's just the water gets hotter and hotter.
And then there's AI, which makes the water so damn hot that it just gets really ugly.
Yeah. Now, you make a great point because, you know, generative AI is, you know, first of all, algorithms are AI. We've had AI for a long time.
Yes.
And this next more powerful version of the same model is going to make what's wrong worse. You know, it's not going to make the harms better. It's going to make them worse. And I would just argue and suggest that logic in common sense says let's fix what's broken before we make the next more powerful version of the same. Let's not just, you know, barrel ahead with a more powerful version of a broken model. It makes no sense. And what artificial intelligence, you know, in the next generation and the one after can do for humanity is going to be breathtaking if it's handled correctly. And again, I would come back to the basic premise. If it's done in a permissioned way where we're saying, okay, yes, you can, or no, you can't use my data for your project, or you can use a part of it, but not all of it. But right now, we're subjects. We're just having our data scraped and exploited, and we have no idea what it's being used for. And I see and feel the same issues that you see and feel out there, which is a kind of a lack of control of our futures, harms to kids, erosion. I mean, we're barely governable. We may not even be governable right now. I don't know. We see, you know, the fabric of our society being torn apart. And rather than feeling helpless about that, let's join in together in a project to fix it, and really return agency to individuals and put people in charge of this technology, not just have the machines drag us, you know, into a future that none of us want.
All right. The book is Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. If you want to find out more, you can go to www.ourbiggestfight.com. Frank McCourt, author of Our Biggest Fight and entrepreneur extraordinaire, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Patrick. It was nice to be with you. I really appreciate your time.
FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOsapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis, and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOSapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOSapiens.com.